This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to Wednesday's edition of the Women's Hour podcast. Now, in today's programme, the centenary of the Women's Engineering Society. Who were those magnificent women and their revolutionary machines? In advance of tomorrow's BBC Music Day, the role it plays in helping cope with dementia. And children and music. How do you inspire them to learn to sing or play an instrument and find someone to teach them? As I'm sure you're aware, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, creator and performer of Fleabag and the adapter of Killing Eve, did really rather well at the Emmys on Monday night. She won 3 awards for Best Lead Actor in a Comedy Series, Best Writing, and the show itself won Best Comedy. And it's now been reported that she's been offered a $20 million a year contract to create new shows for Amazon Prime Video. And she's still working, of course, on the new James Bond film. In her speech, she confessed that the work hadn't been easy.
I find writing really, really hard and really painful. And but I'd like to say, just honestly, from the bottom of my heart, that the reason that I do it is this. No! Oh, my God! No! Thank you. I find acting really hard and really painful. Although this is just getting ridiculous.
Well, her speeches were recorded by the Television Academy. Hetta Howes lectures in literature at City University in London and is a bit of a fan. Emma Bullimore is a TV and culture critic. What did bring what Phoebe described as a dirty, pervy, angry, messed up woman to the Emmys?
I think her ability to stay true to herself, which is a massive cliche, but actually is what she's been able to do. In TV, it's very easy to get your message diluted, to not really be able to stick to what you wanted to say. But she had this really strong voice. Fleabag started as this little 10-minute show, piece of stand-up, then went to the Edinburgh Festival, then the Soho Theatre. And to get it on TV, it was kind of outrageous, and a voice we hadn't heard before, a brand of feminism we hadn't heard before. She liked to call it feminism with personality. And it was such a breath of fresh air. But I can only imagine how difficult it must have been in little meeting rooms at the BBC to try and say, no, I do want to do this outrageous scene. I do want to say that. But the fact that she's been able to get that to the screen and really sort of be unapologetic and brash and bold and fantastic is, I think, what people have really responded to.
Hetta, I know you watched it right from the start.
Yes,
on television.
Big fan.
So what did you make of it when you first saw it?
I mean, I just thought, what am I watching? I've never seen anything like this on TV. It felt really new and really fresh. And I think, as Emma was saying, the fact that it's a one-woman show making it onto TV says something really brilliant about where kind of culture is moving, because it's really difficult to get a one woman show on stage, let alone on TV. It felt
what
very...
did you love about the character and what she was up to? And I remember that first one was really quite shocking.
Yes, very shocking. I mean, you know, a lot of sex, a lot of talking very frankly and honestly about being single, kind of putting voice to things that maybe you're thinking but never say out loud. I think that's what what I loved about the character is that she's not afraid to say anything. And because there's this clever thing in the show where she's kind of speaking to us as an aside, as an audience, as well as to the characters, we get sort of this real insight into what's going on into her head. I think I was newly single at the time and I was watching it and I was like, yes, I can relate to what dating is like in London.
Emma, what is it though about her work, the way she puts it together, that makes her stand out?
It's so intelligent and slick and quick, and you don't get room to be bored or to linger at any point. But it's also just really funny. You know, it's an enjoyable thing to watch as well. It's so dense. It's the kind of show you can't really watch while you're doing something else or you're on your phone. It requires your commitment. And it's one of those that actually gets better. I think Series 2 is actually stronger than Series 1. And the fact that, you know, she's taken someone like Andrew Scott, who had a massive profile from Sherlock and the theatre and all sorts of things, and almost taken credit for his whole career because everyone just sees him as the hot priest now. It's such a fresh voice, and she still feels like someone you'd want to go to the pub with and just have a pint and be normal with. She has that quality that people like Olivia Colman, Sheridan Smith have, that she can stand at the Emmys on top of the world and you still feel like you could have something in common with her because she was so relatable and natural.
I know you've met her a couple of times. How similar actually is her own character to Fleabag?
Well, she always says a lot of her is in Fleabag, and I think there is quite a lot of overlap. But I met her at the very beginning of it all, at the first press screening for the first Fleabag, and she, you know, she was just very unassuming. You know, she was proud of the show, but no one really knew what was about to come. And then I met her many years later when it all kicked off, but she still was the same person. And I think that's key to it all, really. You know, it's so, that show is her, and obviously she brings herself to all of her work. But Killing Eve is based on someone else's book, and everything else is taking all sorts of influences, but Fleabag is her through and through, and I think you see that on screen, and that's why it is so successful.
There's a now rather famous photograph, Hedda, that's been appearing in the newspaper.
Yes.
Of her sitting in a very dramatic chair.
Looking fabulous.
What did you make of that photograph?
I mean, for me, it just says sort of almost a microcosm of the show. She's looking kind of glamorous and totally in control of herself. She's having a cigarette. She's sort of enjoying the moment. And you kind of almost expect her to sort of turn to the camera and wink at you or something, just like she does in the show. It has that quality about it. And it's just really wonderful to see sort of a woman at the peak of her success, like, yeah, this is kind of unbelievable, but also I'm proud of this show. I believe in it. And I can't quite believe I'm here, but it's great.
She brought it to the West End this summer, the stage show. Why did you not see it at the Wyndhams?
I was desperate to see it at the Wyndhams. I was in the queue. Me and my partner were both trying to get tickets, and I think I was like 1,000 and something in the queue, and I couldn't get near it. And I think that says quite a lot about what a phenomenon she's become, that people were queuing up to try and see her on stage. I would have loved to have seen it because I never saw the original show. I just came to it from the TV version. I've kind of done a lot of reading about the script and things. I doubt she'll ever do it again. I mean, it felt like a one-time thing. Now the show has kind of taken off on its own. Why go back and repeat and kind of do it over again? So I do feel like I really missed something special there, to be honest.
As you said, Emma, she didn't create Villanelle. She adapted the Killing Eve stories. But in her own show, in Fleabag, some of the characters are so bizarre. Her father, her stepmother, she became her stepmother in the second series, her sister, her brother-in-law, why are they all so successful?
Well, I think it's the fact that they are unique. Usually in comedy, in any kind of TV, you are wading through cliches. You've seen these characters a million times before, but they are so... I mean, especially that Olivia Colman stepmother character is incredibly awful, but deliciously so. And it's just her ability to articulate fresh things in a way that we haven't thought about saying before, and to make these characters out of nowhere. And what I really admire about Phoebe is the fact that she's so brave. She could have so easily just written six series of Fleabag. The fact that after making Killing Eve the most successful show in the world, she just says, oh, someone else can write the second series. Are you kidding? You know, people wait their whole lives for these kind of opportunities, and she's pushing on. You know, now she's got this massive Amazon deal that she's just signed. She's going on to Bond, and the future's fantastic, but it would have been so easy. And I think I wouldn't have been so brave. I'd have said, yes, sign me up for more Fleabag forever. You know, I'll hitch my horse to that, you know. But it's a real testament to her that she just keeps chasing new things.
Hetta, how important do you think it is that, you know, she said very clearly there will be no more flea bags after the sad parting from the hot priest. How important is it actually to stop before a series maybe begins to stale?
I think it was such a smart decision. I think, you know, it could have carried on and been amazing, and part of me as a fan would have loved to have seen more. But I think knowing when to stop and creating something kind of complete and sort of its own arc, rather than trying to push it past just for more money, really, and sort of more kind of, oh, we can get a bit more out of this, wouldn't have stayed true to what the show is about, what it's trying to do. That last scene, so many people have said this, sort of critics online, but that last scene is so moving and so beautiful, and it is the ending. I think one of the actress who plays her sister in it said it's poetry, and it is. You know, to have gone back and tried to do something more with it after that wouldn't have been staying true to what the show's doing.
Just one last point, Emma. I mean, British women seem to be doing rather well at the moment. Olivia Colman, obviously, got an Oscar. Jodie Comer won an Emmy for her part as Villanelle. What's going on?
Well, it really does feel like a moment, and I think it's just long overdue, actually. And of course, it's great that there are better roles for women and all that kind of thing. But what I'm really heartened by, as we were saying, is that people like Olivia and Phoebe are just able to be themselves and to not be this glossy version of womanhood that Hollywood has so often supported. But to see someone like Olivia Colman, who we all know from Peep Show days, and now she's up there getting an Oscar, but still being herself. And of course, she looked fabulous, but not, you know, she's not all plastic surgeried up. You know, she is herself. She's got her sense of humour. She's been able to be true to herself in the same way as Phoebe. And I think that is such a powerful message for women, that you can reach that kind of stratospheric level in the most superficial industry in the world, and still be funny and still be fresh. And long may that continue.
I was talking to Emma Bullimore and Hetta Howes. Now, tomorrow is BBC Music Day. It's an annual celebration of the impact music can have on people's lives. And we've been talking to those who live with dementia and find music helps them cope. Sheila is 79 and from Madeley in Staffordshire, where she lives with her husband Paul. They both have dementia. We first spoke to Sheila at a Dementia Diaries event in Birmingham. The group records their experiences and then posts them on dementiadiaries.org. Henrietta Harrison went to meet her in her home and found that Irish Republican protest songs transport her back to her childhood.
I love the difference between Irish folk songs and English folk songs. English folk songs are always sort of tra-la-la, you know, girls picking flowers in Sally Gardens, and Irish songs are always about dying on the scaffold. I don't remember in my adulthood that I was so keen on all of them, but I think with dementia you go back to your childhood. Those memories are very vivid, and whenever I play them I'm back remembering my lovely grandpa and grandma.
On the day.
So you really feel like there's an extra connection with music since your diagnosis?
Yes, I've gone back to the things that I remember from a long time ago and that had real emotional significance a long time ago.
What draws you to that song? What does that song make you think about?
It has lots of very personal layers to it. I love the melody. I remember Grandad singing it. I've always been passionately moved by the Ireland's fight for freedom. I love Irish history. Lots of studying of Irish history and Irish literature in the past.
From the mighty glens of Van-
he died when I was seven, so that we're talking 1947. But he would say to me very conspiratorially, "We have to draw the curtain so the police won't hear us singing this." And so I thought that, I'm sure we didn't. But he liked the idea that they were forbidden songs. And they're lovely, melodies.
Ireland,
he was a little wiry Irishman. He would go out on Sunday mornings, set off at about 5 o'clock in the morning, to walk from where we lived in Newcastle-under-Lyme out into the country to Ashley, which was a walk of 12, 15 miles. And he'd come back with rabbits he'd snared and sweet peas he'd pinched from people's gardens in the early hours of the morning. I mean, he was an absolute rogue. And I can remember talking and talking and talking with him, always stories about Ireland and the history. You know, it was better than fairy stories.
You spoke a little bit about your grandma as well, singing songs. Remind me where you were living again.
My granny and her sister lived in two adjoining cottages with a shared sort of backyard garden and a shared wash house, and we lived there. And quite honestly, I slept in whichever house I felt like sleeping in. I had a bed in both houses. My Aunt Min was very much part of my growing up as well, and she would sing to me too.
And tell me what songs that they used to sing to you.
Lots of Maury Lloyd songs. My old man says, follow the van, don't dilly-dally on the way. It's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me, I'd let her know who's who. Rather sort of anti-men songs in a very subversive way. They really adored songs about women who were strong women.
I've lost my pal, he's the best in all the town, but don't you think him dead because he ain't. But since he's wed, he has had to knuckle down, it's enough to wet the temper of a saint.
I think I said to you before, we talked about popular music, but I absolutely love opera. I don't know how it was that Granny knew about opera, because I say we were a working class family, but she had lots of old records of opera with a wind-up, you know, an old wind-up gramophone, and I used to play them, and I started to love it. And then
at a young age,
at a very young age, from sort of 6 or 7, I would put these records on, you know, very popular things like Loved You Out From Love O.M. and bits of Madame Butterfly, and I loved it. I responded to it straight away, and opera is absolutely my favourite music. I mean, the Marriage of Figaro just moves me to tears. Paul as well, but, you know, we just love it.
If you have a stronger connection to music that makes you happy, that makes you nostalgic, presumably also there's a stronger reaction to songs that make you sad. Oh,
yes, I'm sure that's true in a lot of ways. Although there were some very bad parts of it, because Nanny and Auntie Min were quite often ill. You know, they were elderly and quite often had to go to hospital. And when they were, I was farmed out to various people, and some of those were really bad experiences. So some of us have memories that are not good to revisit. And that's certainly true of me. The time that they were around, it was absolutely idyllic. They gave me so much freedom, treated me as an equal all the time, although they were quite strict with me. But when they weren't there, it was awful. I really hated it. I remember I often went to stay with a family who lived out in the country, and their three daughters, always treated me as a complete outsider and bullied me an awful lot. And we lived in town, but we had a proper lavatory with a flush shave, but they didn't. And I was a real townie, you know, I just hated this, you know, this earth lavatory that you had to go to, and I always longed to go back and was always a bit afraid that, you know, one of them might die.
And you and Paul are both great opera lovers.
Mm. Yes, we are. I was never keen on Wagner, and as he was saying to you when you first came in, he'd learned to like Wagner with his fellow students. And we sort of came together to the Mozart. He's not as keen on Italian opera as I am, but he absolutely loves Mozart.
Lacidarem la mala, la mi dirai di sì.
You say that actually you actively see how opera music can calm him down. He also has dementia.
Yes, he's sort of got the beginnings of vascular dementia, partly I think because of his very heavy smoking. And sometimes if I play some music, particularly at night when he's, you know, he can't settle, and he'll sometimes go to sleep. Not as often as I'd like, but sometimes.
I think once you said, when I last saw you, you said that he groans sometimes when certain music comes on with pleasure.
Pleasure. Yes, it was Mozart again. It's that beautiful Loved You at Lacidarem la mala, where it's, I think, the most seductive song in the world, where Don Giovanni's asking, trying to seduce a young serving maid. And it was on the radio, and I just sort of held my Kindle, my tablet, advertised, around the door of his study, and he went, oh.
do you feel about music going into the future? I mean, do you know how your disease is likely to affect you in the future?
Yes, and one of the things that pleases me is that having, as I say, I've been a carer for mum, for dad, how important music was to them at the very end of their lives. Music was still having its transformational effect. One of my happiest memories of my mother, it was only a couple of days before she died, my sister and I were sitting on either side of her holding her hands. One of my happiest memories. Just struck her hands because, you know, she was our dying mum and we were there. And suddenly the Blue Danube came on the ward radio. We used to call her the Dancing Queen. She was still going to dances when she was in her 80s. And suddenly she started to sway up with our hands in perfect time to the music. And I said to her, look at you dancing with your daughters. And she picked up first Gina's hand and then mine and kissed it. I think for both Gina and me, we'll never forget that. For that moment, there was our dancing queen back again.
And so does that, you know, I mean, it's a very crude question, but do you sort of think how music might help you in the future? I mean, are you telling anyone the music that you love?
Yes, I mean, well, they know. My son occasionally rings up and says, oh, God, you're not fighting the Battle of Vinegar Hill again, are you, Mum? But yes, they know my music and they'll make sure I have it because they know how important it is to me. They know me very well.
Bye, Paul. Don't get up.
OK.
Will I be able to find my way out?
Yes, go right to the lift.
Yeah.
And then down to then you don't need any buses or anything to get out. Take care, drive
Yeah, carefully. Thank you very much.
No, you're going the wrong way.
That way.
I've almost got dementia, don't you?
Bye.
Sheila was talking to Henrietta Harrison and the music was wonderful. Now, still to come in today's programme, more music in advance of BBC Music Day. How do you inspire your child to take up singing or an instrument? And the Radio 4 drama, Just a Woman. Earlier in the week, you may have missed Jane's conversation with Sally Challen, recently released from prison after she was cleared of murdering her husband. She'd served 9 years. Her crime was reduced to manslaughter with diminished responsibility. If you missed the live programme, all you have to do is catch up by downloading the BBC Sounds app. Now, 100 years ago, the Women's Engineering Society was formed. That was 1919, soon after the First World War, which had brought more women than ever before into the profession. Well, Henrietta Heald is the author of Magnificent Women and Their Revolutionary Machines. Henrietta, how many women were involved in actual engineering during the war?
Well, we think there were up to 1 million. And they were doing, some of them were doing really skilled jobs. It wasn't just working on the production line. I mean, a large number were, of course, doing shell filling jobs, but many of them had been actually specially trained at a great expense. And they were doing everything from wiring battleships to assembling aircraft parts to running steam turbines in electricity generating stations.
So had the training been established as the war began, or did some of them have some experience before the war began?
Well, some of them did. There were one or two women, who'd been to university, and Rachel Parsons, who founded the Women's Engineering Society, was one of the. She was the first woman to study at Cambridge, mechanical engineering. That was in 1910. So she was well trained before the war, but during the war there was a kind of crash course, basically, because it was acknowledged that there was no way we were going to produce all the munitions that were required without having trained women, because so many men were away at the front.
What happened to them when the war ended? And I know the answer to this question. I knew it even before I read your book.
Well, they were required to go back to the home. They were no longer needed, they were told. And not only that, there was a law brought, although the there was a threat of a law brought in that would ban them from industry. And this was a result of a deal that had been done during the war between the trades unions and Lloyd George, who'd been Minister of Munitions at the time. And the unions would allow women into the factories on the condition that after the war it would return to how it had been.
Why were the trades unions so opposed to women going out to work?
Well, I mean, the main reason was they're taking our jobs. I mean, but also there was a big worry that they would depress wages, because the mistaken belief that women would accept lower wages, and men would thought that would be through, you know, go through the industry as a whole. But in fact, Women's Engineering Society was one of its main planks was to campaign for equal pay for women and good working conditions.
And actually, during the war, the working conditions hadn't been too bad, had they? The factories had looked after them rather well.
Well, they had. They'd got. I mean, for many women, it was the most exciting time of their lives. They had new experiences. They went in. They had, for the first time, they had properly paid jobs. They had proper health care, because actually what the government realised, these women had to be well looked after in order to really be productive. And they had one wonderful thing was that they had childcare facilities on site. Many of the munitions factories actually had creches, and the government was paying up to 75% of the cost.
And after the war, they all just went.
Overnight, everything disappeared. And there was, of course, a lot of unemployment in the early 1920s. So that, you know, there was the climate was very against women, but the Engineering Society became this campaigning force.
So who were the women who were behind the foundation of the society?
Well, the main one was Rachel Parsons. She was the first president. She'd been a director of her father's firm in Newcastle during the war, one of the first women to sit on a major industrial concern, the board. And she was a really feisty character who actually was determined that women should have... now they have, just after, of course, they just won the vote for December 1918, had been the first election women could vote. And Rachel was saying now they have to have their economic freedom, their economic independence, and this is how we're going to do it. And she was that... she actually stood for Parliament in 1923 in order to further the cause of women's rights. I mean, there were only two women at the time, and she didn't succeed. But she was of that, you know, very feisty nature.
Caroline Hazlitt was significant. Why was she important?
Well, she was very important too. She was another. Well, she was the first secretary of the society, but she'd also been. She had actually done some proper engineering during the war. But her great passion was electricity, because what was happening at the time was that electricity was being made available to the masses, but only gradually. Caroline saw that it was the key to women's liberation, because it would get rid of the drudgery in the home. I mean, remember that in those days there were no gadgets available. I mean, everything was done by hand, and it took all day to do the laundry, to do the cooking. And so Caroline Hazlitt, her great sort of mission was to get electricity into the home, cookers, electric cookers, washing machines, irons, hoovers, all the things we take for granted now, but of course they weren't there.
Now, Beatrice Tilly Schilling, this has a very interesting nickname. She was known as Miss Schilling's Orifice. Why?
Well, it wasn't her name. That was her invention.
Okay.
No, that was her invention. And she was an electrical engineer, trained, university educated, worked at the Royal Aircraft Establishment in Farnborough. And during the Second World War, she was aware of there was a lot of crashes happening in Spitfire and Hurricane aeroplanes when they went into a dive, or they were either fighting, you know, fighting in the Battle of Britain, and they were either escaping their enemy or trying to chase him. And often the plane crashed. And what was happening was that fuel was shooting up. But they called it negative gravity. So all the fuel was not staying where it should be in the carburetor. It was actually, it was causing the engine to cut out. And what was happening when it was in a dive, the plane crashed. So she invented a circular disc which was put into the carburetor, which became known as Miss Schilling's orifice.
And that fixed the problem.
And it saved many lives.
Just one more question. Mm. Rachel Parsons, she met a rather untimely end.
Oh, it was horrible. It was horrible. I think of it as a tragedy because she had so much going for her. She promised so much, and she was highly intelligent, but she was unconventional. She didn't marry, she didn't have children, and she became more and more an object of suspicion because she was outside the normal expected behaviour of women. And she went to train. She became a trainer, not a trainer. She went to Newmarket to become a racehorse owner. But even that, the hostility there was profound to women. Even in this was in the 1950s by this time. And she, I'm afraid to say, she met a violent death. She was killed by a stable boy. And it was a shock, of course, the most horrible shock. But what was even worse, in a way, was that she was then vilified herself. In order, the defence, when it came to trial, he was charged with murder. He was, in fact, convicted of manslaughter on the grounds of provocation. And that was through the provocation, according to his defence counsel, was caused by Rachel. She was the victim, but she was blamed.
Henrietta Heal, thank you very much indeed for being with us. And I'll just mention the title of the book again, Magnificent Women and Their Revolutionary Machines. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, so far, in advance of BBC Music Day, we've heard how important it can be for people who have dementia. But what about children, when not every school provides tuition and a private teacher can be expensive? How do you inspire a child to learn an instrument or have singing lessons? Well, Molly Newton is a music teacher and lead of the York Music Hub. She joins us from the York studio, and Yolanda Brown plays the saxophone. But you didn't bring it with you, Yolanda, did you?
No.
I was so looking forward to hearing you.
No one asked, but I'm looking forward to encouraging the parents. That's the aim of the day.
What inspired you into music in the first place?
I think just being surrounded by hearing great music. My dad has a fantastic vinyl collection. So at home, growing up, you'd always hear different genres of music, from classical to opera to soul. And I think I just wanted to be a part of that. You know, it's wonderful to be able to listen to music and dance and sing, but there's something else that to be able to actually create it yourself from yourself. So from the age of 6, I started to ask my parents if I could have lessons.
And what did you start on?
The piano. Piano was my first. We had a piano, electric piano at home, and I loved just going up to it and just playing, making a sound and creating a feeling, if you like. And I wanted to learn it a bit deeper, and so went into a sort of traditional way of being taught the instrument.
And why the sax?
So I found the saxophone around age 13. So a bit later on, I played the drums. I wanted to play a wind instrument, sort of going through that traditional teaching. It's great, you know, but being forced to practice for exams and things like that wasn't quite how I flourished. And listening to music, I loved horns. I loved hearing, you know, the horns in orchestras through to Latin music. And the saxophone called to me, and it really felt like my voice, but actually became self-taught on that instrument because I wanted to express myself in the way that I wanted to, not just for the examiner.
Now, Molly, I know the national curriculum includes music up to the end of primary school. Yep. What are children supposed to know by the time they leave primary school?
Well, according to the national curriculum, by the end of year 6, children should have had opportunities to play music, to experience music, to improvise, to compose, to kind of appreciate and understand what music is about, to have a knowledge of music history. But also, by the end of year 6, the national curriculum expectation, in England anyway, is that children should be able to read notation, including staff notation, which I think is possibly a bit of a big ask in some primary school settings.
Now, you said in England, I know you think Scotland had a different system, Why do you think it's better?
I don't necessarily think it's better, actually, in Scotland. I think they've got a different approach to music education, and actually it works well in some places and less well in others. But I'm no expert on Scotland. I think a national curriculum does give people some guidelines to work from, which are helpful. But I think there is certainly a little bit of a crisis in music education, particularly in primary settings, where the provision is patchy, and for some teachers the curriculum is off-putting because it feels unattainable, I think.
Yolanda, you know, people will sometimes say, oh, the arts, you know, that's on the side, that's not so important, whether it's drama or music or whatever. What did studying music do for you, besides just learning to play? What did it add to your wider education?
Absolutely. It gave me a creative output. It gave me ownership of something. I could create, I could perform if I wanted to, or I could play for myself. It was a very therapeutic experience for me, especially when I found the saxophone and sort of stopped my lessons and started to just improvise and play for myself. And I think that there is something in music that needs to be taught in school as well. And I'm glad that you said improvising there in terms of the national curriculum, because that's the element of creativity. And it is an art. Absolutely. It should be something that young people should be able to create and feel proud of, yeah, and actually affect their audience or affect their peers, work together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the wonderful part of music that sometimes gets lost when we're focusing on sort of getting a grade or being able to assess how people have learnt music. Mm-hmm. We must remember that it's an art form. And actually, when we go to concerts, you know, and see young other people expressing their art, that's the part of music that we enjoy as consumers. That's what we should be getting young people to experience.
But at the same time, Molly, yeah, you do have to know the basics, don't you? Where do you get the basics for a child who wants to play the piano, wants to play the violin, wants to play the saxophone, and then go on to do her own work on it or his own work?
It's a very, very interesting question, because it comes back to what's the right age to start? How do you introduce children into music? There are different schools of thought about how that works. I think there's no such thing as too young. You know, we expose ourselves to music all the time, and children, in fact, just what Yolanda was saying, those opportunities for inspirational events. You know, there was a CBeebies proms series recently. I know Yolanda was involved in that.
That was,
and
great.
Yeah, it was a brilliant chance for young people to go and experience music, very, very young people. And it's those things, Jenny, that spark, that inspiration, that moment. I was a child. I was one of those children who went to a concert. My parents gave me that opportunity, and I came away thinking, I want to do that. And now, how do you start that? You ask questions. So in most cases, you approach your music hub or your school, preschool, early years, that is a bit of a gap in provision for sure. And hubs should be signposting things that are available for parents. It's finding a way to make children feel like music opportunities are for them, and make families feel that they're for them. They're not exclusive. You know, if you can make a child feel engaged in music, then the next step is that they want to get involved, like Leolanda said, listening and performing and creating. That's all part of the same pie, really. We all want a part of that.
Yolanda, you did say at one point that you got a little bit sick of practicing and doing exams and
yes,
all of those kind of things.
Yeah.
But clearly at some point you have to do that kind of stuff. If you're a parent and a child is saying, nah, I'm not going to practice my piano or whatever, how do you persuade them that it matters?
I think that you need to allow that child to take ownership of the music. And I find that a lot of the times when children don't want to practice, it's because they're being told to sit down and basically do homework. You know, it's sit down and practice what your teacher has told you. The moment they hear their child going off on a tangent, they say, oh, no, get back to what you're doing. Allow your child to have some free time with the instrument as well. You know, oh, this is a song I made up, Mum. Can I perform it at Christmas? You know, all of that sort of energy and excitement about music still needs to be instilled. And then the actual practice that you want the child to do will come naturally.
Briefly, Molly, which is the cheapest way of actually getting tuition on which instrument?
Well, the absolute cheapest way for children in primary school is to be accessing the whole class ensemble teaching that goes on in many schools across the country that music hubs support. I spoke to a child yesterday in a whole class setting and asked why they think it's a good idea to do music like that, if they do. And they said, everybody gets a chance to do it here, to try before you buy. You get to have a taste, you don't have to go anywhere, and everything's here. So the instruments are provided for free, and the setting is school, so nobody has to get anywhere. And it is a brilliant opportunity. Nobody knows what they're good at until they have a go at it. You don't know what you like until you get, until you try it. And I think that's a brilliant starting point. But well, just really quickly about the practice, it is a wonderful thing to do if you can support as parents, to know that it is difficult, but it is worth persevering. 68% of parents don't think there's enough music education happening for our young people, and parents can support them at home. It is a brilliant thing if you can do it.
I was talking to Molly Newton and Yolanda Brown. On the Magnificent Women and Their Revolutionary Machines, Lucky emailed, the pioneers being celebrated today paved the way for those of us who followed. I obtained a BSc building in 1987. We were two females among a cohort of 40. I chose to follow a path in international development, much of it in housing and infrastructure in low-income communities. A really rewarding career I may not have enjoyed had I taken any notice of social norms and poor careers advice. I'm looking forward to attending the Women's Engineering Society Student Conference later this year, being among a cohort of young, dynamic engineering professionals is a real privilege and pleasure. A reminder, change is happening despite the slow pace. On inspiring your child to take up music, Susan said, I learned to read music, as did most of the class, by attending recorder lessons at primary school. They were once a week, half an hour after school. We paid 25 pence. After 1 year, we owned the recorder. Mies said, remember, local brass bands offer free tuition and instruments and a warm welcome to young musicians. Sadie said, my son, 10, was desperate to learn the saxophone, but we couldn't find a teacher for love nor money. I live in Chesterfield, hardly the backwaters of the UK. He's learning the drums instead, but it's such a shame. He would have loved it. Alison said, your guest wondered how a working-class gran knew about opera. Maybe the same as mine, who would queue for tickets outside the theatre in Birmingham, to be joined by Grandpa when he'd finished work. They were fortified by the sandwiches and thermos of tea prepared for the purpose. Opera wasn't an upper-class phenomenon. Ordinary people like them would play the music on violin and piano together before gramophones came into being. It's only the recent inverse snobbery that it's not for the likes of us, which is now being broken down. Now do join me tomorrow if you can at 10:02. I'll be speaking to the 5-time Grammy Award nominated composer and electronic music pioneer Suzanne Ciani. She joins us to discuss a career in music which spans more than 40 years. And what does it take for a mother to stop loving her son? Tracy Ann Oberman plays a woman whose teenage son is accused of violent sexual crimes in Mother of Him, which is being performed at the moment at the Park Theatre in North London. Anupama Chandrasekhar is a playwright whose play, set in India, examines a similar crisis when The Crow's Visit opens at the Kiln Theatre on the 23rd of October, and they will both join us tomorrow in the studio. Try and be there, 10:02, as I said. Until then, bye-bye.
I'm Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton. We're the host of ICYMI, Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And we want to help you make sense of the need-to-know internet stories of the week.
Consider us your internet historians of past, present, and future.
Of the good, the bad, and the truly unhinged.
From nuanced takes on stories we're all closely following, to the ones you wished you heard about.
In case you missed it, that's ICYMI, the podcast that's extremely online, so you don't have to be. Follow and listen now.